This is Latino USA, a radio journal of news and culture. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
On May 2nd, 1993, Latino USA took to the airwaves. And we're still on the air and online, too, inviting you to stick around for the next 20 years and then some. And on this show, more than 12 million Mexicans live in the U.S. So what's Mexico's stake in U.S. immigration reform?
I think citizens on both sides of the border need to understand that they have to be co-state holders to success on each side of the border.
And the view of a pocho in Mexico.
Everywhere I turn, it seems there is one more young Mexican-American or American-Mexican eagerly making a new life here.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa as we celebrate our 20th year on the air. This week, President Obama visited Mexico this week to meet with President Enrique Peña Nieto. The visit came amid U.S. efforts to reform its immigration policy. A new bill, still under discussion, could legalize some 11 million undocumented immigrants. More than half of them are Mexican nationals. With so many of its citizens living and working on U.S. soil, what's Mexico's stance, if any, in how our immigration policy is shaped? Is it affected by relations between the two countries? Arturo Sarucan is the former ambassador of Mexico to the United States. He joins us from Los Angeles, California, to talk about U.S.-Mexico relations and immigration reform. Welcome to Latino USA, Ambassador.
It's a pleasure, Maria.
There are fingers that are pointed at Mexico all of the time. If Mexico did a better job in terms of treating its citizens, they wouldn't need to migrate. If Mexico was able to get a hold on the war on drugs, then the violence would be curtailed and people wouldn't feel like they had to migrate. As a former government official of Mexico, you can understand the finger pointing and the frustration with people who say Mexico needs to do more, not less.
Mexico needs to create jobs and needs to create economic growth so that we can anchor those entrepreneurial and bold women and men that cross the border. But I think finger pointing is the worst recipe, because very easily Mexico could retort in a jingoistic and nationalistic, and some would say in a fair and balanced way, saying, well, yes, we've got an endemic challenge in enhancing the rule of law and fighting back corruption that allowed drug syndicates to operate. But you, the U.S., allow guns and laundered money coming across the border into Mexico that feed the ability of the drug syndicates to kill and to corrupt. I don't think that the future of these two countries can depend on finger-pointing. I think citizens on both sides of the border need to understand that they have to be co-state holders to success on each side of the border. If the U.S. and the U.S. Congress can get this immigration bill approved, Mexico and the United States can sit down to hammer out how we will conduct, implement, administer a future worker program that will bring workers into construction, into the services industry, and into the ag business here in California.
For, let's say, Mexican citizens to have a kind of guest worker reality in the United States where it's not permanent, or what's being discussed in this immigration reform bill, a kind of temporary status that is not a guest worker, it's not a legal permanent resident. Would this be acceptable for Mexican nationals to have this kind of in-between status now for perhaps another decade or two?
There's a significant number of Mexicans that, if given a chance, are not interested in pursuing citizenship. They simply want to be able to come back and forth legally in an orderly manner with a visa to be able to work and go back to their families. Now, we can't blot out the sun with a finger. There are very significant numbers of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans who know no other country than this one. And so providing a path to regularization of their immigrant status is a key component of any immigration bill. So the challenge here, Maria, is that the bill will have to be able to chew gum, whistle, and talk on the BlackBerry at the same time.
And finally, the increasing number of immigrants from the South will probably be coming from countries in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador, the poverty, the crime. So what does this do in terms of the Mexican government's role as being a country that is not a sender, but a country that is a pass-through?
We are a transit point. That opens up huge challenges in terms of how we try and ensure orderly flows through Mexico. Mexico had done in the past a pretty bad job of confronting the issue of transmigration through Mexico. It is getting its act together in the past administration, in this administration, to try and ensure that migrants are treated the same way that we ask migrants to be treated in the United States. I'm the son of conflict refugees on both sides of my family, Maria, who came to Mexico at the beginning of the 20th century in the 1918s, and then after the Spanish Civil War. Mexico has always been a country that has had a very forward-looking asylum and refugee policy. And that has to be the basis of how we rethink how Mexico and others deal with these transnational migration patterns that at the end of the day are not a threat to the security of our nations. These are hardworking, mostly law-abiding, mostly tax-paying, hardworking women and men that are simply seeking to provide food and a better future for their families.
Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
It's a great pleasure, Maria.
Arturo Sarucan is the former ambassador of Mexico. He joined us from Los Angeles, California. Congress has appropriated nearly $2 billion in assistance to Mexico. 15% of those funds hinge on improvement in Mexico's human rights situation. In the 7 years since the Mexican government launched its war against the drug cartels, 60,000 people have been killed and an estimated 25,000 have disappeared, further contributing to Mexico's demoralization, mounting evidence that the police and government forces are responsible for much of the violence. In a visit to Mexico, I saw the toll that this is taking. About 200 women have crowded into a meeting room at a Mexico City university, anxious to tell their stories to a visiting human rights delegation. All of them claim to be mothers, wives, sisters, and daughters of people who have disappeared. 21-year-old Nenetzin Escobar Riojas sobs as she tells her story.
Desde pequeña nos han educado para correr, pero ya no puedo correr más. Tengo 21 años. Estoy cansada de ver tanta violencia.
I'm tired of seeing so much violence, Nenetzin says through her tears. I'm tired of so much death.
Yo deseo que vivan y vean tanta muerte que he visto yo.
Nenetzin says her parents were environmental activists fighting the timber industry in the state of Guerrero when they were kidnapped in an ambush that, according to witnesses, included state and local police. Nenetzin believes timber companies operating in the region had something to do with the kidnapping of her parents.
Ahora ellos han sido secuestrados por policías del estado.
How do you know that they were detained by the police? And then you say it's a kidnapping, but it's the police who have them. And you've actually spoken with them?
Existen muchos intereses en el país de México.
There are many interests at work in Mexico. Unfortunately, local police are often bought. They have agreements. Organized crime uses the police to capture and kidnap people. In this case, our parents. The police collaborate because it's in their interest to do so.
En este caso, nuestros padres que fueron secuestrados colaboran con ellos porque tienen intereses.
State and local police in Guerrero have denied involvement in this case, but it fits a familiar pattern. In February of this year, Human Rights Watch issued a report about Mexico. They looked at 249 cases of enforced disappearances. In 149 of the cases, they found credible evidence that soldiers and police had participated.
It's difficult to understand the situation here in Mexico because it is so utterly outrageous.
Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy, spoke to us by phone from her office in Mexico City. She says what's happening today is due to a weakened rule of law. The Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI, ruled the country for more than 70 of the last 80 years. During its long rule, Carlson says the justice system worked in the service of the party.
The court system was essentially developed to sustain that party in power. It wasn't really, in many ways, a justice system. And the court system still functions, or doesn't function, in order to sustain the powerful in power.
And Carlson warns that President Peña Nieto, himself a member of the PRI, may overlook another aspect of the growing violence. The militarization of border regions, where the drug war is being fought, has resulted in greater numbers of women who are killed or disappeared. In the state of Chihuahua, the murder rate for women increased 1,000% between 2007 and 2010.
This president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has not had a history of recognizing or attacking the problem of violence against women. In fact, the reverse is true. He was governor of the state of Mexico when 26 women were raped in police custody and effectively blocked prosecution for the police agents who were responsible for that.
Back at the gathering of women waiting to talk to the human rights delegation, many say they're simply ignored when they report kidnappings or disappearances to the authorities.
Mi nombre es Olga Esparza, y yo vengo en representación del Comité de Madres y Familiares de Jóvenes Desaparecidas de Ciudad Juárez.
Olga Esparza heads up the Committee of Relatives of Disappeared Victims in Ciudad Juárez. Esparza's 26-year-old daughter, Mónica, was last seen in March of 2009 at the university she attended. Esparza says, in 4 years, there's been no serious investigation of her daughter's disappearance.
Existen prejuicios a nuestras hijas desaparecidas, donde en algunos casos...
The authorities are biased against our disappeared daughters. They tell the families they left with their boyfriends. They insinuate they're prostitutes or drug addicts, with absolutely no evidence to prove that in these cases.
Y si tener evidencia en estos casos.
A decade ago, when you would hear stories about crimes against women or women being disappeared, did you ever imagine that it would be you who ends up telling your story about your daughter?
No, claro que no. Para mí esto es una pesadilla. Para mí.
Of course not. When I'd hear those stories, I tried to block them out. Now I wish this would just be a nightmare, that I'm just dreaming. I dream of my daughter and I don't want to wake up.
Y no quiero despertar.
Only a small percentage of the cases reported to the police are ever investigated, let alone result in a trial or a conviction. So the feeling of impunity, that no one is ever held responsible, leads to even further violence, say human rights activists. Mexican President Peña Nieto has promised to reform the justice system and to step up investigations into cases of human rights abuses. Now, the whole world is waiting to see how he'll carry out those promises. Our story on Mexico was produced by Maria Martin. Coming up on Latino USA, the music is sublime in Santos, a new choral work sung by the San Francisco Girls Chorus.
With every work of art, we want for the piece to speak not only in the physical realm, but in the realm of the spiritual.
That's coming up on our show. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Commentator Daniel Hernandez thinks a lot about questions revolving around identity and geography. He's a U.S. native of Mexican ancestry and has spent the last 6 years living and working in Mexico City. Residents there affectionately call themselves Chilangos. Daniel and others like him are usually called Pochos because they come from the United States. But lately, Hernandez has noticed those lines are blurring.
When I first lived in Mexico City for a summer more than 10 years ago, I was usually the only one of me I saw around, the only Mexican born in the U.S. Sure, there were a lot of returning migrants who had lived in El Otro Lado, the other side, in a city that's home to 20 million people. But when it came to being a kid from the true blue USA, on the subway, at the markets, or sitting in traffic, I always felt I was a solitary pocho, lost in a sea of chilangos. Weirdly, there were fewer people who even understood what I was. It was always, "Are you Mexican, but you sound so American?" Or, "You're American, but you look so Mexican." A few times my oddball status brought me trouble. A few times it brought me perks. Let me explain. For a lot of people, being a pocho somehow made me an unassuming symbol of the United States, and therefore someone worth scamming for the sake of a blip of cosmic justice for the continent. But these days, after I talk in the California/Baja accent that I can't shake, people no longer say, "Oh, I know someone who lived there." Now they say, "Oh, I've been there." It happens even with cabbies. I once had a cabbie who told me how he had worked in 10 different states in the US, as casually as how someone says they've been to Disneyland or the Statue of Liberty. Transmigration is a new way of life in Mexico. As demographers tell us, more Mexicanos are not just traveling to the United States, they're looping back and forth between their home communities in Mexico and their second home communities north of the border. The good part about this for me is that pochos are now a real, tangible thing for the average Mexicano. We're no longer alien or even anomalies. It's like we're just a part of the fabric in Mexico City now, kind of like all the immigrants the city has received from Spain or Haiti or Argentina, or even the Anglos, people who visit because their instincts tell them to and then end up staying for good. Everywhere I turn, it seems, there is one more young Mexican-American, or American-Mexican, eagerly making a new life here. People understand what we are, and they no longer put us down for it. Because here's the little secret that links us all. The truth is, everyone in Mexico is becoming a little bit pocho. Family ties, the internet, and mass media have helped us fuse our cultures together, and the trend will only continue, no matter how long or tall they make that border fence.
Daniel Hernandez is a writer living in Mexico City, home of the Chilangos and the Pochos. This week is the world premiere of Santos, a new choral piece by composer Gabriela Lina Frank and playwright Nilo Cruz. The San Francisco Girls Chorus is headlining. Radio Bilingüe reporter Farida Yavala Romero has more.
Santos is the story of a woman from Latin America who is carving a saint out of marble. The work is tough and her fingers are sore, but she's also struggling in another way, to bring out the sacred in her creation. Nilo Cruz wrote the lyrics to Santos. He's the first Latino playwright to win a Pulitzer Prize.
I think with every work of art, we want for the piece to speak not only in the physical realm, but in the realm of the spiritual.
Juliana Wilsinski is one of 29 girls in Corissima, the concert group in the San Francisco Girls Chorus. She's almost 16. She has been singing here for 7 years, but she has never sung anything quite like this.
Really different. Just having to learn these really long pieces of music requires a lot of practicing and stuff, but it's really cool. The final project is amazing.
Like the others, 14-year-old Livia Camperi gives up 3 to 4 afternoons a week to rehearse.
Honestly, after a really long school day,
the last thing I want to do is spend 2 hours standing and reading music and singing everything. But then when I come to chorus, it's really cheesy, but it's like I forget everything. Like, really, like, I just get so into the music.
Learning music is like an artichoke.
That's conductor Brandon Brack.
You have all of these different leaves, and we keep pulling back, and it gets meatier and more delicious till you get to the heart of the artichoke, and that's where the music lives.
The music for Santos was composed by Gabriela Lina Frank. She has worked with the Chicago Symphony, LA Philharmonic, and Philadelphia Orchestra. She's well known for drawing from her Peruvian heritage to create classical music that mixes in Andean styles and instruments. It's something she shares with Nilo Cruz, who was born in Cuba.
We have a very similar creative process where we do come from Latino / Latin American background, but we're not hidebound by it. It's often the backdrop for something more intimate, at the same time universal.
In Santos, the saint who is being carved comes alive. At the same time, the sculptor feels a disquiet creeping in. Nilo Cruz.
She has a moment of crisis where she starts to doubt her own creativity. She starts to doubt what is taking form before her, which is the human aspect of the artist. We all have those moments.
Then comes redemption, when the sculptor remembers to look within herself. She never really lost her spirituality. It was there all along. And what makes her realize this? She looks up to the sky and sees the stars.
I think it's the grandness of the universe, and also is a way of noting that the stars are not just outside, but they're also within us. And everything in the heavens, there's a replica of the heavens in us. But it just is up to us to look for that in our soul and through our work.
Santos premieres this weekend with members of the Berklee Symphony and singers Jessica Rivera and Rachel Calloway. The girls' chorus has the starring role. For Latino USA, this is Farida Jabala Romero in San Francisco, California.
And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, go old school, pick up the phone and dial 646-571-1228. You can also friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, where we are Latino USA, all one word. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. Latino USA is produced by the Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business and Executive MBA program at Yeshiva University. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.